May it please the court. The respondent, Pierre Clay, was charged with unlawful possession of a firearm under Section 571.070 for possessing a firearm after previously being convicted of a felony. Respondent was convicted of unlawful use of a weapon for carrying a concealed weapon in 2010, and then again he possessed a firearm on January 26, 2015, giving rise to the incident case and offense. The circuit court dismissed the charge against Mr. Clay, the felon in possession of a firearm, for the same reasons set forth in the Robinson case that the court just considered. The court cited the same opinion given in the Robinson case as the grounds for the dismissal in the Clay case, finding that Section 571.070 is unconstitutional under the amended Article 1, Section 23 of the Constitution. Article 1, Section 23 was amended in 2014 by Amendment 5. And that amendment was passed by the people in light of the Heller and McDonald decisions that found the right to bear arms under the federal constitution to be an individual right in Heller, not connected to service in a militia, but then also McDonald finding it to be a fundamental right that was incorporated and applied to the state. Much like the state of Louisiana, which passed an amendment in 2012 to their constitution, subjecting the right to bear arms and any restrictions on the right to bear arms to strict scrutiny, the purpose of Amendment 5 was to make a declaration about the right to bear arms in the state of Missouri, that that is an unalienable right, and to help protect that right from future erosion by the judiciary or the legislature, because both Heller and McDonald were decided by narrow margins in the Supreme Court. Both were 5-4 decisions. And that was kind of the background that Amendment 5 was passed under, and the purpose of Amendment 5 to really embody that strict scrutiny review and requirement in the Missouri Constitution and protect that from any changing court decisions. In this case, the offense date of the respondent's case was January 26, 2015. That was after the effective date of Amendment 5, which took effect September 5, 2014. Because the offense date was after the effective date, it is the amended version of Article 1, Section 23 that would apply in this case. As the court had stated in both Merritt and McCoy, that is the Constitution that was in effect when the offense took place that controls. But both of those precedents, along with the Dotson precedent, still apply and control in this case. Both this court decided in both Merritt and McCoy that before the Article 1, Section 23 was amended, strict scrutiny applied. After Article 1, Section 23 was amended, strict scrutiny is still the standard of review. As it states in the language of Amendment 5, any restriction on these rights, the right to bear arms, shall be subject to strict scrutiny. That test is the same test both before Amendment 5 took effect and after Amendment 5 took effect. In Dotson, this court held that Amendment 5 acted as a declaration of the right to bear arms and the standard of review, that it did not make any fundamental change to the law of the right to bear arms in the state of Missouri. And that after McDonald was passed, declaring the right to bear arms a fundamental right, that this court would review any restriction on the right to bear arms under strict scrutiny. Amendment 5 has that same requirement, which was why it was not a fundamental change to the state of the law in Missouri. Strict scrutiny requires the state to prove that it has a compelling government interest in the restriction and that the restriction is narrowly tailored to further that compelling government interest. Like the state of Louisiana, this court has found the felon in possession law to survive strict scrutiny. Louisiana subjected their felon in possession law to strict scrutiny, and their Supreme Court also found it to pass the strict scrutiny test in state.
Opposing counsel says that was more narrowly written, though, than the law at issue here.
It is. The statute in Louisiana is different. It does specify specific prior felonies, and it does have a restriction on the length of time under which it can be applied. But the statute in Missouri is still narrowly tailored enough to survive a strict scrutiny review. The compelling interest that the state has is the protection of the public safety and ensuring and reducing the firearm-related violence in the state of Missouri. And throughout the country, we've seen an epidemic of gun violence lately, and this is, just shows just how compelling the state interest is in protecting public safety from firearm violence. The law we have in Missouri, though broader than the law in Louisiana, is still narrowly tailored. It applies to felons that have a conviction not someone who received a suspended imposition of sentence, which has been held to not be a conviction, not someone who's been arrested for a felony, not someone who's had that felony expunged, not someone who has possesses an antique firearm. There are exceptions to the law, and this court held that those exceptions make this law narrowly tailored in both Merritt and McCoy. And this rests on the fact that felons are more likely to engage in violent gun use and more likely to commit future crimes than law-abiding citizens. This is a finding that's been made not only by the Supreme Court of Louisiana in that Eberhardt decision, but by federal courts throughout the country in United States versus Barton from the Third Circuit and United States versus Yancey in the Seventh Circuit, which this court rests its finding of narrow tailoring on from the Merritt and McCoy decisions. We don't have to rest it on statistics. We can rest it on the case law and the findings that have been made throughout the country that felons are more likely to engage in illegal and violent gun use than law-abiding citizens. That fact makes this law narrowly tailored. The other note is that narrow tailoring does not require...
Is there empirical evidence that nonviolent felons like money launderers or tax evaders are more likely to commit violence to other people with guns than violent felons?
I'm not sure there's an empirical finding that nonviolent felons are more likely than people with prior findings of violence, but they are still all felons, violent and nonviolent, are more likely to engage in violent gun use and more likely to commit
a crime.
Well,
is there empirical data that a tax evader is more likely than a person who speeds through a speed trap more likely to commit a violence to someone than someone that isn't?
There are empirical studies that show people with some types of nonviolent crimes like drug possession are likely to commit future violent crimes. There have been studies showing that...
That's drug possession. Okay, that's one issue. But I'm saying about tax evaders or people that write bad checks or people that commit bank fraud. People that are, but they don't really charge people who commit bank fraud with anything. But I'm just saying that people who commit felons in the banking industry or insider traders, are they more likely to be the drug people? That's a rational. That's a something people can conclude. But someone who does inside trading, they're going to be more likely to kill someone than not?
I'm not aware of any empirical studies specifically related to tax evaders or people who commit insider trading, but the legislature is never going to be able to perfectly determine exactly who has had an increased risk of that future violence and future illegal gun use. And the legislature has made the determination that all felons pose that increased risk of potential gun violence.
Are there cases that give us any guidance as to how or to review that legislative determination? Judge Teitelman's question suggests breaking that out into subgroups that maybe the legislature didn't create. Are there cases that give us guidance as to how much we're supposed to second guess or review what the legislative determination was under strict scrutiny? I know there are certainly under rational basis.
I don't believe so. I think that the determination is up to this court under the strict scrutiny standard, which is what applies. And Section 571.070 passes the strict scrutiny test, as this court has held in both Merritt and McCoy, whether it's applied to a tax evader or whether it's applied to someone like Mr. Robinson with a prior for unlawful use of a weapon. The nature of the prior conviction is not the issue in the case. The narrow tailoring applies to anyone with a prior felony conviction, as this court decided in both Merritt and McCoy.
And of course, that would follow rational basis would be fine. Rational basis, it'd take months to do rational basis, but then we're applying strict scrutiny.
And strict scrutiny requires the narrow tailoring, but narrow tailoring does not require exhaustion of every conceivable alternative. The Supreme Court held that in Grutter versus Bollinger, and this court cited that decision in both Merritt and McCoy. Though there might be other options that would be narrowly tailored as well, this current statute is still narrowly tailored, and the court's precedent from Merritt and McCoy finds that fact, and the court should continue to follow that precedent. The Section 571, if it were to be more narrow or apply to fewer felons than it currently does, it would prevent the law from effectively furthering that compelling state interest of reducing gun violence. The previous version of Section 571.070, before it was amended in 2008, only applied for a very short time frame and only to a limited class of felonies. And very few people were prosecuted under that statute, and it still allowed a lot of people who posed a potential risk of increased violence to carry guns legally in the state of Missouri. And so having a more restrictive version would not effectively further the compelling interest of reducing firearms-related violence. Both Merritt and McCoy are the applicable standard in this case. They both have already held, this court has already held, that Section 571.070 meets the strict scrutiny standard, that the state has the compelling interest, and that this law is narrowly tailored enough to further that interest.
And when the trial court issued its judgment, it didn't have the benefit of Merritt or McCoy or Dodson II at the time, did it?
That is correct. The trial court's decision was issued in February of this year before any of those decisions came out, and I think it was at that time it was unclear as to whether that would be found to meet strict scrutiny, but now that this court has reviewed the law under strict scrutiny, which it hadn't done before, it is clear that this law survives strict scrutiny, and the court should continue to follow and apply that precedent in this case. Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Dave Rowland. I'm the author of the amicus brief submitted on behalf of the Freedom Center of Missouri, and I've also been asked to speak on behalf of the respondent, Pierre Clay, for the purposes of today's argument. Your Honors, this case is about far more than just the right to keep and bear arms under the amended version of Article 1, Section 23. The result in this case will have a bearing on every other constitutional right that the people of Missouri have attempted to protect under the Constitution of Missouri. Part of the reason for that is that the people have set out in unambiguous, express terms that they intend for this right to have the highest possible level of constitutional protection. If this court decides that highest possible level of constitutional protection allows people to be completely divested of this right for willingly or knowingly failing to use the characters ADV colon as the first four characters in the subject line of an unsolicited commercial email message, which is a Class D felony under Section 407.1138, for engaging in a pyramid sales scheme, which is a Class D felony under Section 407.405, for unlawfully receiving food stamps, which is a Class D felony under Section 578.377, or for failing to properly submit reports required of registered lobbyists, which is a felony for a second offense under Section 105.473. If strict scrutiny allows the complete denial of a constitutional right when there has been no evidence presented to this court suggesting that people who have committed these acts are any more likely than any other citizen to engage in an act of violence?
You're basically suggesting that the overbreath doctrine applies outside the First Amendment context in your argument.
Yes, Your Honor. Okay. Your Honor, if I may, you raised the question in the previous argument, I believe, about whether there were more than one versions of strict scrutiny. You actually raised this issue in your concurring opinion in Dodson. You suggested that perhaps strict scrutiny doesn't always mean strict scrutiny, that it might mean something different in the context of one constitutional right versus the context of another constitutional right. I hold the position that's absolutely incorrect. strict scrutiny is supposed to be the highest version of constitutional protection. And if we admit varying degrees of strict scrutiny,
Well, you'd have to admit that strict scrutiny has been applied differently, the test has been applied differently, depending upon the fundamental right at issue. That's not me, that's the United States Supreme Court, which courts, I feel bound to follow.
Courts have applied strict scrutiny differently in different contexts. I would like, in my argument, to address part of that. However, I would also argue that that was incorrect. And I would argue that part of the problem with that approach is exactly what we saw in the outcome in Merritt and McCoy, where the court professed to be using the strict scrutiny standard, but in fact did not follow the type of analysis that courts have followed for decades when applying strict scrutiny. In other words, this court didn't require the government to prove that the restriction it intended to impose was necessary to advance a compelling state interest. In the absence of any actual evidence, the court said, well, we think this is close enough. That's not strict scrutiny. That's more closely akin to rational basis.
But that's what you're saying. The argument has been made, what do the people think they're voting on? But as you note, the U.S. Supreme Court has said that it has applied strict scrutiny different in regard to fundamental rights than it has in some other areas. And so you're asking us to find that we're wrong, which is problematic that we could do that. But moreover, what makes you think the people thought that was wrong and wanted some different definition of strict scrutiny applied to fundamental rights than the U.S. Supreme Court applies?
Your Honor, I'm not proposing that this court should say that the U.S. Supreme Court was wrong in the way that it was applying strict scrutiny. The U.S. Supreme Court has isolated a few very narrow contexts in which it varies the application of strict scrutiny. That's within its right to do. This court's responsibility in applying Article 1, Section 23, as amended by the people, is to provide the highest level of constitutional protection.
What's to provide strict scrutiny? So, again, that begs the question of what it means.
Well, Your Honor, as I was saying, if there are varying degrees of strict scrutiny, then this court's obligation is to apply the highest
and
degree.
And where do you get that from? I'm asking because the Constitution says shall apply strict scrutiny. It doesn't say shall apply the highest level of review. So to aid us in evaluating that argument, is there a case you base that on or something else that you
It's based on the text of the amendment, Your Honor.
Okay.
Unlike any other constitutional right, the people have chosen to define this right as unalienable. That is not a superfluous word. It's a word that has a concrete meaning. If you look to the dictionary definition, I think that it's so unambiguous it doesn't need to go to a dictionary definition, but if it's ambiguous in any way, you go to the dictionary definition, and it says it's incapable of being removed from the person. Now, to the extent that the people did acknowledge that strict scrutiny would apply, and that therefore there would be some circumstances in which a law could conceivably pass muster, even though it restricted the right to keep and bear arms. The use of the word unalienable to describe the right indicates that whatever exceptions there are that strict scrutiny might find must be extraordinarily narrow, hence the highest possible protection. And Your Honor, as we pointed out in our brief, despite what Senator Schaefer said in his briefs before this court, which I must point out were not evidence, they were not sworn testimony, we presented newspaper articles quoting Senator Schaefer telling Missouri citizens all over the state, if you pass this amendment, your right to keep and bear arms will be subject to the highest possible protection.
But isn't that irrelevant? We don't have any, let's say, of history. We don't go back and say, this legislator said this or they said that. We're there to interpret the legislation as passed and the constitutional amendments as passed. Regardless of what the proponents say.
Your Honor, I absolutely agree that what Senator Schaefer told the people of Missouri when he was going around touting Amendment 5 is every bit as irrelevant as what he told
That's
this
freedom
court.
Of speech. That's his freedom of speech.
It's his freedom of speech. It's not a binding position on what this amendment is supposed to mean. That's got to be determined by looking to the language that the people adopted. And I want to remind this court, the people did not vote on Senator Schaefer's brief. The people did not vote on Heller. They did not vote on McDonald. They voted on the language that is now Article 1, Section 23 of this Constitution. I'm going to have to say it, the flaw in Dotson and McCoy and Merritt was not starting with the language that the people adopted. In Dotson and Merritt and McCoy, in part because no party presented the proper arguments to the court, so this court was a little bit hogtied because it was not given the proper standards for applying a constitutional provision. But in the absence of that guidance, this court essentially said, whatever Senator Schaefer says the law means, the law means. And it did not address the language of the Constitution.
The court didn't say that, but if the court agreed with your interpretation that it wrought a very substantial change in the law governing the Second Amendment, wouldn't it not be the law now? Because the ballot summary would have been invalid?
Your Honor, that's a conundrum. I believe that Dotson reached the correct conclusion in that there was no evidence that Missouri voters were unclear on what they were voting on. That is not the reasoning that the court used to reach its conclusion. I do believe that Article 1, Section 3...
Nor is that the standard that we're supposed to apply.
Well, we can't relitigate Dotson. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, this now that Article 1, Section 23 is unambiguously part of the Constitution, the question is what this court's going to do with it. And I would say that it is manifestly incorrect to say that the meaning of a constitutional provision has to be bound by saving interpretations that were adopted in a prior case. The meaning of the constitutional provision is tied directly to its words. And if the words are inconsistent with what the court suggested in dicta when it was dealing with a hypothetical situation in Dotson, then what it said in Dotson needs to go by the wayside. This court is bound to respect the words adopted by the people themselves.
Do you agree with the statement in Merritt and McCoy that this court applies strict scrutiny to rights that the United States Supreme Court has deemed fundamental?
I agree with the principle that it should.
And that it has.
I would not agree that the court has applied strict scrutiny, particularly not in Merritt and McCoy.
It said that it was a fundamental right and it applied strict scrutiny. The version that, it was narrowly tailored, compelling state interest, you'd have to agree that that is a version of strict scrutiny that the United States Supreme Court has applied.
Your Honor, I agree that those were the words that were used. I submit that if you compare the substance of there was no evidence presented in Merritt or McCoy suggesting that all felons are more likely to commit violence at some point in the future. There was no evidence. And the whole idea of strict scrutiny, let's take a step back. The idea of strict scrutiny is, number one, the court is required to consider the law that's being challenged unconstitutional if it clearly infringes on a protected constitutional right. Now, this court has shifted away from that standard, but we cited several precedents of this court saying that you do not presume the constitutionality of a law that clearly infringes on constitutionally protected behavior. This court has drifted away from that, but it erred in doing so, and Judge Teitelman and Judge Draper in particular have pointed that out.
Again, is there a Second Amendment or other state comparable amendment case that looks at the individual defendant and decides whether or not they fit within the broader category adopted by the legislature?
Your Honor, the question of an as-applied challenge is not novel. In all various types of constitutional rights, courts have dealt with as-applied challenges. I would point out particularly in the Fourth Amendment.
Do you know of a Second Amendment case that does that, is my question, though?
I am not aware of a Second Amendment case that has dealt with it. I would also point out Second Amendment is inapplicable when we're talking about a completely unique provision of the Missouri Constitution. And Your Honor, that's another thing we emphasized in our brief. No other state in the entire country has a provision that announces the right in the emphatic terms that Missouri announces. The Second Amendment surely does not. Missourians have had for nearly 200 years now the opportunity to adopt the Second Amendment as the standard for this state if they chose to. They have chosen not to. What they chose was to declare this right unalienable, to say that it applies not only to firearms, but to the keeping and bearing of ammunition, firearms accessories. They've specified ever since 1820 that it's an individual right, whereas that's only been clear about the Second Amendment for 5 years or so now. They also specified, and this is again critically important, that there is a distinction for the purpose of Article 1, Section 23 between people convicted or convicted violent felons or people who have been adjudicated by a court to be a danger to themselves or others as a result of mental illness and everyone else. What this court did not appreciate and did not even touch on in Merritt and McCoy is the fact that saying that that the legislature now faces no boundaries in imposing gun restrictions on the vast range of felons who have never been convicted of a violent felony, it suggests that the words that people of Missouri adopted making that distinction are completely superfluous. It renders them void of meaning. I have a particular point.
Let me ask
point.
A particular yes. question about a recent case. Are you familiar with the Richardson versus Green case that dealt with the issue of whether involuntary manslaughter was a crime involving violence such that the sentence could be shortened?
I'm not familiar with that case, Your Honor.
Okay.
I want to specifically point out one aspect of this matter of specifically designating convicted violent felons versus other types of felons. Your Honors, I actually helped draft that language. And there was an intention.
So could you solve the question of inalienable versus unalienable for us?
They're seen as being the same thing, quite frankly. Unalienable was chosen because that was what was in the Declaration of Independence.
Thank you.
Why was it chosen?
Because that's what Thomas Jefferson used in the Declaration of Independence.
It was inalienable.
What's that?
Inalienable.
I believe it was unalienable. Nonetheless, the inclusion of those two terms discussing the convicted violent felons, it means either that the people were concerned that this court would be so protective of the right to keep and bear arms in light of the strict scrutiny standard that they had to clarify, but wait, you can indeed restrict the rights of convicted violent felons or people adjudged to be mentally incompetent.
The last time this statute, before it was amended, it actually said dangerous felons as opposed to violent felons.
That's correct. That demonstrates more narrow tailoring.
Which is different. You think it's more or less? For example, we held that involuntary manslaughter was a crime involving violence such that you couldn't reduce the sentence. But somebody who commits involuntary manslaughter might not be considered dangerous in the sense of armed robbery, comparatively speaking. So how would those, you're suggesting that every, would it be the facts of every plea of guilty and conviction, or would it be the charging document that was looked at to perform this, the type of strict scrutiny that you're suggesting is required by the amendment?
This is an individual right, and so the appropriate analysis would be the actions of the individual.
Regardless of the crime, in other words, the underlying facts of the crime and the underlying facts of the individual involved would be used under your version of strict scrutiny.
I believe that's the correct interpretation. I will say, Your Honor, that insofar as historically it has been understood that the right to keep and bear arms does not apply to convicted felons, I want to emphasize that historically that was aimed at the common law felonies. So we know the common law felonies were homicide, mayhem, arson, rape, robbery, burglary, larceny, prison breach, and rescue of a felon. So when historically courts have talked about the right to keep and bear arms not extending to convicted felons, it was talking about those felonies.
The lobbyists who failed to file a report?
No, Your Honor, they were not aiming at lobbyists that failed to file reports. They would not have considered the right to keep and bear arms restricted for lobbyists who failed to file reports or for people who participated in a pyramid scheme. But Your Honors, in particular, they would not have considered the right to keep and bear arms to be denied, that someone could be punished with prison time when their only offense is having exercised their right to keep and bear arms. Pierre Clay's only offense on this record is that he was carrying a handgun for self-protection. When he was 17 years old, that was his offense, carrying
Excuse
a handgun.
Excuse me, your time is up. Thank you.
For 200 years in the state of Missouri, the right to bear arms has never been considered an absolute right. It's never been considered an unconditional right. The passage of Amendment 5 does not change that.
Why include nonviolent felons?
I'm sorry, could you repeat
that? Why include that language? Violent, convicted violent felons as opposed to nonviolent felons, as opposed to any other type of felony. Why include violent felons in language of the amendment?
By including that language in that last sentence, it does say nothing in this section will be construed to prevent the General Assembly from regulating that. And I believe that sets that restriction, if there were to be a law specific about violent felons, it sets that apart and makes it clear that that would pass the strict scrutiny review. But that doesn't limit other restrictions, and that doesn't increase the rights of nonviolent felons, as this court noted in Johnson, and has been noted by the Supreme Court in Heller, that long-standing prohibitions on felons possessing firearms are not cast aside, not thrown into doubt by the court's decisions in Heller and McDonald. The Amendment 5 envisions that there will continue to be restrictions on the right to bear arms. It says any restriction on these rights will be subject to strict scrutiny.
But in Heller, I think they left that up to the states. And so when you pass a constitutional amendment in the state of Missouri, it can go further than, or less than, well, it can go further than what the federal government says as far as protecting people's rights. Clearly, Amendment 5 was intended to protect people's right to bear arms. I mean, that's the purpose of the amendment.
Yes, I agree. That's the purpose of the amendment. But that doesn't mean that there can't be restrictions. Those restrictions just have to be reviewed under the strict scrutiny test, which this court did in both Merritt and McCoy, and found Section 571.070 to survive strict scrutiny. Those precedents continue to apply here. And in those cases, in Merritt, McCoy, and in Dotson, the court rested its opinions on the words of the statute, not on the ideas of Senator Schaefer or the briefs. It rested those decisions on the words of the statute, that strict scrutiny
But to the extent that those cases are based on the commitment of a crime that existed before the constitutional amendment, it can be read in that context. Anything else is dictum.
Well, the nature of Amendment 5, as was noted in Dotson, did not fundamentally change the law. If it had, that ballot title, which was noted in Merritt, that ballot title might have been considered unfair or insufficient. But since strict scrutiny applied both before Amendment 5 and after Amendment 5, that analysis of Section 571.070 is the same, both before Amendment 5 and after Amendment 5 took effect. And I would ask that this court vacate the dismissal and remand the case to the trial court for further proceedings.
Thank you. Case will be submitted.